This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
On the short flight to Dallas, it was only 13 minutes, President Kennedy had a dish of pineapple and cup of coffee. He added 4 spoonfuls of sugar. In Fort Worth that morning, he had given a tough speech aimed at critics who said he was too soft on national security. He planned a similar address for deeply conservative Dallas, a city that had rejected him in the election of 1960 by a wide margin. A Houston congressman, Albert Thomas, had a warning for the president. If I were you, I'd be careful what I said in Dallas, Thomas said. It's a tough town. There was no response from Kennedy. His top aide, Ken O'Donnell, then had some good news. It looked like Texas Governor John Connally and Senator Ralph Yarborough, who had been feuding, would patch things up, giving Kennedy what he wanted, the appearance of political unity among Democrats in the Lone Star State. Air Force One had begun its descent into Dallas, and Kennedy was pleased. Terrific, he told O'Donnell with a big smile. That makes the whole trip worthwhile. I'm Paul Brandis. You're listening to Countdown to Dallas, a podcast series based on my book of the same title. There was some other good news, too. The rain that had lashed the Dallas-Fort Worth area that morning was gone, and it was now a glorious day. WFAA reporter Bob Walker.
And now we have a lot of blue sky showing and a bright sunshine. And that sunshine feels mighty good, too, believe me.
Air Force One landed at 11:38, and soon the 2 people everyone had been waiting for appeared to a great roar.
There's Mrs. Kennedy, and the crowd yells, and the President of the United States. And I can see his suntan all the way from here.
The emergence of Jacqueline Kennedy was particularly memorable. Robert McNeil of NBC, and making his first ever presidential trip, remembered it vividly.
It was so bright, my eyes ached in the sunlight. And then when Mrs. Kennedy came out and with this pink strawberry ice cream colored suit with the facings of navy blue turned inside out and the little pillbox hat to match, her hair glossy in this bright light, the vivid color and everything, it looked surreal, surreally colorful. It made the eyes ache to watch.
He noted that at every stop in Texas, Mrs. Kennedy had been given yellow roses, but not in Dallas.
When somebody at the foot of the plane handed her a huge bouquet of blood red roses, the color of those roses in that bright sunlight against the pink of the suit was really startling.
The perfect weather meant that the top would not be on Kennedy's limo. Now, there's nothing fishy about this. The decision to keep the top off the car was made by President Kennedy's top aide, again, Ken O'Donnell, who knew the boss always wanted the top down so he could be seen by as many people as possible. In 1964, he testified, quote, "Well, I would make that decision under normal circumstances, but it was almost an automatic decision that whenever the weather was clear, he preferred to ride in an open car." And here's O'Donnell in a rare interview from November 1973, a decade after the assassination.
"And it was a beautiful day. We used to call it Kennedy weather. Beautiful blue skies, and a million people turned out, very enthusiastic, very sentimental, and very friendly."
In prior episodes, I've shown how Kennedy, who that very morning had discussed his possible assassination, a frequent topic for him, often took risks with his safety. He had done so in Fort Worth, and now at Love Field in Dallas, he did so again.
The president is up to the fence now, shaking hands with people. The president and his wife are right up on the fence. The press is standing up high, getting a lot of shots of this. He's done as he has done in several places. He's broken away from his planned plan and gone right up to the fence to shake hands with people. This is great for the people and makes the eggshells even thinner for the Secret Service, whose job it is to guard the man.
Presidents, after all, are politicians and thrive on meeting voters. At one point, the Kennedys got separated in the crowd. An anxious Jacqueline Kennedy asked, "Where's my husband?" "Oh, there he is," she said. And it wasn't just the Secret Service protecting the first couple. It was all hands on deck for the Dallas Police Department. There were 365 policemen at Love Field alone.
Dallas police out here in force today, doing a beautiful job of handling the crowd.
80 more were at the trademark where Kennedy would speak. Jesse Curry, the police chief, had canceled all leaves and borrowed firemen, sheriffs, state police, Texas Rangers, agents of the Texas Department of Public Safety, and from the governor's office. All told, a small army, some 700 officers, were on duty to ensure the president's safety. The precautions were enormous, and yet Dallas's reputation preceded itself. As the Kennedys worked the airport crowd, the editor of the Texas Observer, Ronnie Duggar, wrote, quote, "Kennedy is showing he is not afraid." But fear was in the air. Time correspondent Hugh Seide said he was tense. So was Congressman Henry Gonzalez, who said, quote, "I sure wish somebody would invent a spit-proof mask." And he added, quote, "And I forgot my bulletproof vest." Finally, it was time to go.
Mrs. Kennedy stepping in the car first. Now the president, they both in the back seat now.
And the motorcade pulled away, Secret Service agents yards and precious seconds behind the president's car.
The presidential car moving out. The president and first lady. Big, beautiful Lincoln.
A local reporter told Chuck Roberts of Newsweek, quote, "After Kennedy leaves here, they won't let anybody get within 10 feet of him." As discussed in prior episodes, motorcade routes were publicized in those days, in that more innocent era. Everyone knew where the president would be, and the streets were packed.
And on Harwood, it'll turn on Main, from which point it'll go all the way down to the courthouse area, which is the end of Main. It'll turn on Houston Street to Elm under the Triple Underpass.
High school student Juanita Nunez and some friends stood at the corner of Lemon Avenue and Turtle Creek Boulevard.
And they looked so beautiful. I'll never forget the way Jacqueline looked in her little pink hat and her pink suit. She just looked beautiful. They were both smiling.
But one of her friends, Juan Jose, was nervous.
While we were standing there waiting for the motorcade, he was looking up at a couple of buildings there in the area and just kind of keeping an eye up there. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, you know, I'm just looking at some places where there could be people." And I remember thinking, I was totally innocent of that idea or that thought. And I remember thinking, why would you even say that? Why would anyone want to harm the president?
And people could and did get close to the president. Ray Addington was also in high school.
And so I just stepped off the curb and went over to the car and shook hands with him. You know, and he had a grip.
The car was obviously moving slowly. In fact, it stopped twice on Kennedy's orders. Once when he saw a group of children behind a sign that said, quote, "Mr. President, please stop and shake our hands." Kennedy actually got out of the car to meet the children. William Manchester, in his magnificent 1967 book, The Death of a President, says the president, quote, was nearly swept off his feet by the surge of shrieking youth.
This was a real political trip. It was maximum exposure. Open cars. The president had instructed us not to be up in the back of the car. He wanted it not to appear there was anything between he and the people. He wanted the people to have the belief that he was just one of them. And so that's the way we went in the motorcade from Love Field into downtown Dallas.
That Secret Service agent Clint Hill, the safety of Jacqueline Kennedy was his primary responsibility. A woman watching Kennedy on the street with the crowds loved it, but for some reason it reminded her of a radio program she had just heard that very morning discussing the Lincoln assassination. The woman turned to her husband and said, quote, "President Kennedy ought to be rewarded the Purple Heart just for coming to Dallas."
More Countdown to Dallas right after this quick break.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II. And people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.
In Dealey Plaza, the president's limo now some 4 miles away, people were gathering. Abraham Zapruder, who had rushed home to get his movie camera, was back and contemplating where to get the best home movie of the president going by. And at the Texas School Book Depository, the red brick building at the corner of Houston and Elm Streets, workers were breaking a bit early for lunch, most intending to get a close-up view of the motorcade too. What about Lee Harvey Oswald? A co-worker, Bonnie Ray Williams, saw him on either the 5th or 6th floor, he wasn't sure which. Oswald, who rarely spoke to anyone, asked Williams to, quote, "close the gate on the elevator and send the elevator back up." Asked if he was sure it was Oswald, Williams said, quote, "I am sure it was Oswald." But the last employee known to have interacted with Oswald prior to the assassination was Charles Givens, who claims he definitely saw Oswald on the 6th floor. Here he is in a 1967 CBS News documentary.
He's standing about midway of the building on the 6th floor.
What was he doing there?
Well, he was just standing there looking with his orders in his hand.
And what did you say to him?
I just said, "Fella, it's lunchtime. You going downstairs?" And he said, "No, I said, close the gates on the elevator when you get out." Well, I was, you know, kind of excited, wanted to see the parade, so when I got outside, I really forgot it. I just rushed on off and went on out to lunch.
This would be about what time?
Well, about 1 or 2 minutes after 12.
So Oswald, on the 6th floor, according to Givens, said he was not coming downstairs. Givens mentioned that Oswald had his book orders in his hand. Oswald often went up to the 6th floor to fill those book orders, but it should be noted that after the assassination, the clipboard with those book orders was found, and Oswald had not filled any of those book orders. So, what in those final minutes before the shooting was he doing up there on the 6th floor? Seems like a fair question. So, after being spotted on the 6th floor, no one else in the entire depository would see Oswald again until some 90 seconds after the assassination. But minutes later, Oswald nearly was discovered. An employee I mentioned a minute ago, Bonnie Ray Williams, took his lunch and returned to the sixth floor to eat. He had a chicken sandwich and bottle of Dr. Pepper. Why the sixth floor? Williams said, and I'm quoting, "Well, at the time, everybody was talking like they was going to watch from the sixth floor. So I thought everybody was going to be on the sixth floor," unquote. Williams sat by the third or fourth set of windows looking out over Dealey Plaza, but he could not see the southeast corner to his left, where three bullet shells would later be found. He couldn't see too much, he would testify, because the books at the time were stacked so high. I could not possibly see anything to the east side of the building. Williams realized his buddies were actually on the fifth floor, one floor down, and went there after finishing lunch. The timing of this is also interesting. Williams' sixth floor lunch coincides with witnesses down below in Dealey Plaza who happened to look up at the corner window, again, just steps from where Williams was eating, and saw a man sitting still, quote, like a statue, unquote, and holding a rifle. Why so still? Perhaps Lee Harvey Oswald, not moving, not making a sound, was afraid of being discovered by Bonnie Ray Williams. Conspiracy buffs often cite others who claim to have seen various people, some armed, elsewhere on the upper floors of the depository. But detailed examinations of those claims and or the background of those people call into question their veracity and or penchant for exaggeration, very human behaviors. But the lifespan of such anecdotes is eternal, thus and understandably giving conspiracy buffs something to point to six decades later. Meanwhile, directly across the street from the depository's front entrance, construction worker Howard Brennan was on his lunch break and decided to stay and watch the president go by. He sat atop a small ornamental wall, clearly visible in the home movie that Abraham Zapruder would soon shoot. As he waited for the motorcade, Brennan looked around. He saw three men on the fifth floor. That would be, as I mentioned, Bonnie Ray Williams and his buddies, James Jarmet and Harold Norman. Two other co-workers were there too, but not at the window at that moment. And then Brennan's eyes drifted one floor higher and saw another man, this one alone. Howard Brennan, 44 years old, was farsighted, meaning his distance vision was excellent. The man he saw on the sixth floor was, he would later say, unsmiling and seemed very calm. The unsmiling man in the corner window was seen by others as well. Two men, Robert Edwards and Ronald Fisher, were standing on the southwest corner of Houston and Elm. Edwards, looking around, also happened to look up at the depository's sixth floor window. "Look at that guy," he said. "He looks like he's uncomfortable," or words to that effect. Both Edwards and Fisher thought something was odd about the man. Fisher said, quote, "The man held my attention for 10 or 15 seconds because he appeared uncomfortable for one, and secondly, he wasn't watching. He didn't look like he was watching for the parade. He looked like he was looking down toward the Trinity River and the Triple Underpass down at the end of Elm Street. And all the time I watched him, he never moved his head. He never moved anything, just was there, transfixed," unquote. Could it be from an earlier point that I made that Oswald, afraid of being heard by Williams as he was eating his lunch, remained still and quiet, not moving? Meanwhile, the president's car turned right onto Main Street, Clint Hill now clinging to the bumper. They were about 1 mile from Dealey Plaza, the time about 12:21.
We got down to Main Street, and it would point, at some points it was difficult to get through the crowd with the motorcade. The local police were doing everything they could, but it was a challenge.
NBC's McNeil.
The street ahead of the motorcade looked like a river whose banks were constantly shifting because people would swell out in the crowd and then swell back, and you wondered how the motorcade could get through them because they were weaving sinuously through this crowd of amazing to see. And the reception was euphoric, unbelievable.
Again, in this more innocent era, bystanders could get uncomfortably close to the president. His car was driving quite slow, and there are photos, perhaps you've seen them, of William Greer, Kennedy's Secret Service driver, with his car door ajar, his way of keeping crowds away. Again, a more innocent era. Here's Bob Huffaker of KRLD Radio.
Here comes the first car with Police Chief Jess Curry and Sheriff Bill Decker. And here is the President of the United States. And what a crowd, what a tremendous welcome he's getting now. We can, and there's Jackie. She's getting just as big a welcome. And the crowd is absolutely going wild. This is a friendly crowd in downtown Dallas as the President and the First Lady pass by.
You've no doubt seen images from these final moments. The weather was perfect, the president beaming, and Jacqueline Kennedy radiant with big smiles and waves of her white-gloved hands. In the Secret Service follow-up car, a dozen feet away, Dave Powers, a close friend and aide of JFK, thought they looked like Mr. and Mrs. America. And then Main Street and its huge friendly crowds gave way to the green expanse of Dealey Plaza. The motorcade turned right onto Houston Street. The time, 12:29. Here again, Clint Hill.
We went about a block, turned left on Elm, and that put us in the middle of Dealey Plaza. And at the corner of Elm and Houston sits a building. It's seven stories high. It's called the Texas School Book Depository. As we approached the building, we, the agents, in the follow-up car, the car immediately behind the president, which is an open car, like the president's car, viewed that building. We noticed that there were like three windows open on the side of the building that we were approaching. There were some workmen sitting in one of those three windows. Didn't see anybody in the other two. Now, we didn't think much of it because all the way up and down Main Street, there were windows open and people were hanging out of windows on balconies, on fire escapes, on top of buildings. And so it was just kind of the norm.
There's no question that the occupants of the president's car saw the book depository looming dead ahead. They were headed straight for it. As Hill noted, nothing seemed unusual. And yet, in one home movie taken by Robert Hughes, we see something that takes our breath away, images of the president and someone in the sixth floor window. The figure in the window moves ever so slightly. No gun is seen in the Hughes film. Perhaps Oswald, now satisfied that his prey is drawing near, hid his rifle from approaching cars and vigilant eyes until the very last second. What did it look like from that sixth floor window? You might not know it, that a lesser known home movie gives us a tantalizing look at that very moment. It was taken by Elise Dorman, a 57-year-old employee of publishing firm Scott Forsman, from no less a spot than the fourth floor of the depository, just two floors below and two windows to the right of Oswald. It's a remarkable film showing President Kennedy exposed and vulnerable as his slow-moving car draws near. Why didn't Oswald shoot at this point? We'll never know, but it could be that after reading of the exact motorcade route in the newspaper, he had more than enough time to contemplate murder. Some writers have said that Oswald had never seen a presidential motorcade before. He certainly had never seen one in person, but had probably seen images on TV, Kennedy in West Berlin or Ireland 5 months before, or in Tampa just 4 days before, perhaps even Houston the night before, and knew that the president might be quite exposed and that the Secret Service agents might not be close enough to rush to his aid when the moment came. It has been speculated that had Oswald, the trained Marine marksman, fired while Kennedy approached him on Houston Street, the president's driver, Greer, could have hit the gas, could have swerved, and continued down Houston Street past the sniper's lair. Why not let the car turn onto Elm Street instead? If Greer tried to flee there, the safety of the Triple Underpass was some 425 feet away. The president would be exposed for a much longer period of time, and his guards would be turned away from the sixth floor window, not facing it. Indeed, James Zahm, the non-commissioned officer who helped train Oswald to shoot, and in 1964 was in charge of marksmanship training at Marine Corps Base Quantico, Virginia, said Elm Street actually offered the better shot. Zahm testified, quote, it would make it easier because Oswald was in an elevated position, and therefore, if the car was traveling on a level terrain, he would have to keep adjusting by holding up a little bit as the car traveled. But by going downgrade, this just straightened out his line of sight that much better, unquote. Yes, better to be patient, Oswald may have reasoned. And as he waited, what was going through his mind? Did he ever think, even briefly, that the life he was about to take was a father of two adoring children, or that what he was about to do would ruin the lives of his own two children, that they would live the rest of their lives in a monstrous shadow that would forever be cast upon them? It seems doubtful that he had such thoughts, for even a second of such contemplation might have given him pause. Of course, we'll never know.
Now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the trademark.
An hour later, in a hospital classroom, Assistant White House Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff, his eyes glistening in red, made the stunning announcement.
Go on, Matt.
John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas. He died of a gunshot wound in the brain. I have no other details regarding the assassination of the president.
In our next episode, who heard what, who saw what, and who felt what? And what do those who were closest to Lee Harvey Oswald, who knew him best, family, teachers, neighbors, his own brother, his own wife, what do they say? Sound from WFAA Radio, CBS News, the Television Academy of Arts and Sciences, PBS's Frontline, PBS's American Experience, and the archives of Helmer Reinberg. Our editor and producer, Aaron Lamb. Audio engineer, Sean Rule Hoffman. Executive producers, Michael DeAloia and Gerardo Orlando. I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks so much for listening.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.